Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we will be looking for your questions on prescription medications, how to get the full benefit of medicines that you're taking, possibly if you have some questions on interactions and how that can sometimes cause problems. And we're very happy to have here on the show once again as a guest, Dr. James Rybacki. He is editor of the newsletter, The Essential Guide to Medical News. For a number of years, he published a book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and that was published as a physical book on paper. It was updated every year and sold many, many copies. And then he decided maybe a better way to deliver that and other kind of health information was to move to the web. So now he edits The Essential Guide. This is a website, The Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com, where there is information on a wide range of health topics. And he's been with us before on the program to talk about what's new in the world of prescription medications. And we're really pleased that he could spend some more time with us. We also have a special guest here and a kind of a special focus. This happens to be a World Osteoporosis Day. So we're going to talk a little bit about osteoporosis and about treatment of osteoporosis. And as our special guest, we're happy to have Mary Buchsein. She is assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Harvard Medical School. She's also adjunct assistant professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Boston University. And I also want to mention particularly she's a graduate of the University of Illinois, studied engineering here in Urbana-Champaign. And she's joining us by phone, so is Dr. Rybacki, and we're really pleased that both of them could be with us. So general questions, certainly we can take questions about prescription medications, but particularly here at the beginning part of the program, we thought it would be a good thing to talk about osteoporosis. So whatever questions people have, they can call in, and I know the guests will do their best to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Rybacki, hello. Thanks for being with us again.
It's always like coming home.
Very good. And Dr. Buchsein, hello.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, really pleased that you could be with us. I was when I was reading through your materials, I was also pleased to see. That's why I really wanted to mention it, that you're an Illini.
Absolutely.
So we're really glad that you could be with us. And this is particularly appropriate that we should be talking about osteoporosis today since it is World Osteoporosis Day. Maybe I'll ask Professor Buchsein, just talk a little bit about osteoporosis. This is indeed a problem that people all over the world experience. It is more common in women, but it also you do see men with bone thinning. So it's something that probably everyone should be thinking about.
Exactly. We know that osteoporosis is a highly prevalent disease, and it affects over 200 million women worldwide. And certainly we think that due to low bone density, about 1 in 2 women and about 1 in 5 men over the age of 50 will suffer a fracture. Mm-hmm. And these fractures can be very debilitating. They cause not only financial burden, but quite a bit of pain and socioeconomic burden.
And we could talk, I'm sure we will talk about medications that are used to try to slow bone loss. But aside from medications, there are a couple of really basic things that have to do with diet, nutrition, and exercise that people should definitely keep in mind. And they're pretty simple things that people can be doing, should be doing to keep their bones strong.
I think that's, just to jump in quickly, I think that's absolutely crucial. Clearly, there are strong medicines for weak bones now, and we actually have written about that in an Essential Guide to Medical News, that Overcoming Osteoporosis, which is actually an e-book on Amazon. But let me trot out that old horse that I so often trot out. You know, it's always better to prevent a disease or condition than to have to treat it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Marion, I could probably go on for about an hour about risk factors you can't change for osteoporosis. And Mary, do you want to hit some of the ones that you can change?
Well, some of the ones you can change are certainly to pay attention to your diet. And among the components of your diet that are most important for bone health are having adequate amounts of calcium and vitamin D. And we can, you know, have a further discussion about what those levels are. The best sources are clearly in the diet. And outside of your diet, the most important thing that you can do is have regular weight-bearing exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And that will not only preserve your skeleton, but really importantly, help your muscles and keep you from falling down.
And vitamin D is really important. And I think that it seems that we stress that more and more because that's involved in, you can take, you know, take all the calcium you want. If you don't, in addition to have those other things, the vitamin D and then the weight-bearing exercise, then your bones are not going to take that calcium up.
Exactly. So the adequate vitamin D levels are necessary for you actually to absorb the calcium that you're taking. So you're exactly right that that's critically important.
And this is something that just fairly recently, or at least, well, maybe not so recently, but in the past couple of years, we've been hearing more and more about the possibility that people are vitamin D deficient, and it may have to do with poor diet. I'm not sure that people are using enough sunscreen, so that's going to be a problem, but that sometimes comes up. What could you say about what we know about whether people are getting enough vitamin D? And certainly one of the things you want to talk about is, well, what now is the recommended daily requirement for vitamin D?
Sure. Jim, you want to take that?
Sure. So a couple things come up with that. First of all, this has been controversial. This has changed a little bit. And depending on what you're trying to do with it, there's some emerging science. And if I put my heart hat on a little bit, there's probably some question about higher doses. And part of what you're seeing in how much vitamin D you need and what you need to get at a particular age changes a little bit. But you generally see some 600 to 800 IUs, depending how international units, depending how old you are. There's some emerging and interesting, in a couple senses, melanoma prevention data that starts to look at doses about 1,000 international units. And actually from one of my alma maters at Creighton, there's a gentleman there, Dr. Haney, who is probably a vitamin D guru on the planet. And the recommendations there, after the new Let's Prevent a Deficiency recommendations came out, were on the order of 2,000 IUs. So a little bit of controversy. Do you have a little bit different spin on that, Mary?
Yeah, I think the most recent Institute of Medicine report came out last year and suggested, 800 international units. And as you said, not everyone agrees with that. And
right.
The advocates think that more is better. I think the Institute of Medicine gave conservative, safe recommendations. But when we're talking about vitamin D, I think the thing to remember is that, it's the sunshine vitamin. And really the best way to get vitamin D is to be outside with your skin exposed, for 10 minutes a day. And that's part of the reason why we have so much vitamin D deficiency is, people just aren't outside as much as they used to be.
Let me ask you one other question. I have a caller here. They're waiting. I will not make them wait too much longer. But this whole business of vitamins, I'm sure that people find this frustrating because, as you say, if you consult different sources, you'll get different recommendations. And occasionally there always has been some concern about the vitamins that can be stored in the fat in the body and whether you can build up problematic levels. But, occasionally you get either things that vitamins are great or vitamins are a big problem. And just recently, in fact, there's been some reporting about how perhaps people are taking too much. And just one thing in particular, there's been a study here suggesting that's a possibility that men who take too much vitamin E might increase their risk of prostate cancer. So where do you go for advice when it seems like so many people are telling you so many different things?
Well, I'll jump in. I think the easiest place to go is to your own physician who has that benefit. I'm just a guy, and I may have a white coat on, but a guy in some surgical scrubs talking on the telephone. Your physician, he or she has the benefit of your full medical record and the chart. And certainly if you look at some balanced and objective websites, in a heartbeat, I would say www.nof.org, the National Osteoporosis Foundation. Certainly the same www.iofbonehealth.org, very valid site as well, International Osteoporosis Foundation. There's a number of places, National Institutes of Health, that have some very good things. Mary, do you have a couple of favorites that you like?
No, I think those are the key ones. In terms of sort of focusing only on bone health, where I think there's a little less controversy, the idea about how much is not so controversial, 800 to 1,000 international units a day, about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium. But I think what the emerging message is to try to get as much as that as you can out of food sources rather than supplements. And that seems to be where the controversy is how much should you be getting from supplements versus dietary sources?
Yeah. I think that's the clearest thing that also came out more recently. What David was mentioning was actually a study looking at possible benefits in preventing prostate cancer. The trial was actually called the SELECT trial. And this was 400 international units of vitamin E as a specific form. Sorry to put the nerdy zone out there, but it's alpha tocopherol. And there's actually a gamma form of vitamin E, which was not studied. But what was found was very surprising. And actually, I put that on Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. I thought it was shocking because, in my opinion, it was. Here, it was looking at a possible benefit in vitamin E and selenium in preventing prostate cancer. And there's actually a 17% relative increase in prostate cancer versus people who took the placebo. This was in Journal of the American Medical Association, October 12th. And what this says is that, boy, you take 400 IU, international units, of vitamin E for 5.5 years, a very long time in this study, again, seeking to prevent prostate cancer, it actually seemed to increase the risk. And so going back to food sources and rational components, rational amounts, total daily doses, that makes a lot more sense. Mm.
Well, we have a caller here. I want to get right to them. And very quickly, I'll introduce again our guests, Dr. James Rybacki. He's editor of the newsletter, The Essential Guide to Medical News, edited the recent Overcoming Osteoporosis edition. He also edits The Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com, which is a website with lots of information about various kinds of health issues and prescription drugs being one of them. Also joining us is Dr. Mary Buckstein. She is a PhD doctor. She's assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Harvard Medical School. And we're talking some here about osteoporosis, but other questions are, in fact, welcome. And the guests will do their best to help you out with an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in White Heath. And line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling specifically to talk to the pharmacist. In his essential guide to prescription drugs, did they mention when the patents would come off certain medicines?
Oh, that's an important point. When you look at when things do particularly come off patent, in the original publication, which was something of a bodybuilding book, about 1,300 pages, putting more information in the off-patent data didn't happen while I was working with HarperCollins. What I've done now is to actually make them into e-books. I would make two announcements here. There'll be 2012, a first new, albeit somewhat smaller, printed Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And in all of the e-books, on Amazon, they have off-patent information in them, because I think that's absolutely crucial. What happens is when a generic form of a particular medicine, just to jump back to osteoporosis, there's a generic alendronate, Fosamax, the price drops tremendously. And ma'am, are you looking for the consumer benefit there?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Absolutely. And that is something that is very, very critical. Generally, you get about 17 years of patent protection if you're a pharmaceutical company. Sometimes there are some additions and or changes in the product, the pill itself, so those are extended. But the benefit to consumers in that generic, well-formulated medicine is clearly a same outcome and a decreased price.
So we have to wait till 2012 to find out that information, or is there information on the Internet?
Actually, if you Google that, yes. There are a couple reliable sites about that. Sometimes you'll actually find that on the manufacturer's website themselves. So www.nameofthedrug.com, and often you'll be taken to a manufacturer's website, and it'll say, you know, X going off patent in a particular date. So that's a reasonable way to do that. The other way is to talk to your doctor and say, well, Dr. Smith, Is there a generic version of this? How do we do that? You know, within the same family of medicines.
Uh-huh.
And what you would find, for example, in the bisphosphonates is, yes, there's a generic Fosamax that's out there, and you can get the benefit.
Actually, I'm looking for Imitrix.
Ah, so you're actually looking for a medicine to actually look at migraines. And so,
yeah, I
understand completely. If you leave leave your email with the producer, I think there's a way for them to do that. And I'll send you some information about off-patent stuff and a date for you.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
Well, you could, yeah, we could do that. If you'd like, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll put you back on hold, and then fellow who answered the phone when you called in will take your email, and we'll do that off the air, and then we can pass that on to Dr. Rybacki.
There we go.
All right. Thank you
all
very
right,
much.
Thank you. Well, for other people who are listening, you have questions. We're talking about prescription medicines, what they are, what they do. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Talk to our guest, Dr. Tom Rybacki. I'm sorry, Tom. Why do I keep doing that, Jim?
I love that. This is good.
It must be that somewhere in the dim and distant past, I knew somebody named Tom Rybacki because I want... My brain just wants to make you Tom.
David, if you need to call me Tom, you just go right ahead.
Jim, I'm really sorry. No, Jim, I'm really sorry. James Rybacki, he is the editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com. That's a website, and for many years edited this as a book, and apparently it still will be available in a printed version, but it's also available as an ebook. Joining us as well, Mary Buchsein. She's assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Harvard Med School. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, Professor Buchsein, I want to come back to the osteoporosis subject and to talk about going beyond the kind of supplementation that is suggested to make sure that people have adequate calcium and vitamin D. There are also some medications that some people use, and particularly what we're talking about here is postmenopausal women, the SERMs and the bisphosphonates. And particularly, I want to make sure we talk about bisphosphonates because there just recently have been some advisory panels of the FDA looking at these very medicines, and particular trying to assess claims about what's the benefit of taking those over a long period of time, and is there some point where you say actually there is no benefit past a certain point? First of all, just you want to talk about bisphosphonates and what they do?
Sure. I'm happy to address that. So let me take even a step back.
Yeah. Okay.
And in general, all the drugs that have been approved by the FDA have been through rigorous clinical trials, and these trials have been on the order of 2,000 to 7,000 people enrolled, who've been randomized either to the drug or placebo, and the drug was shown to reduce the risk of spine fractures and hip fractures generally over a period of 3 years. And one of the challenges that we face is that none of those randomized trials where we have excellent safety data comparing to people taking the placebo pill were longer than 5 years. And so we're left, you know, sort of with uncharted territory about how long one should treat with these very safe and efficacious medicines. And just to point out, they reduce the risk of vertebral fractures or spine fractures on the order of 50 to 70% and reduce the risk of hip fracture on the order of 30 to 50%. So these are really potent and highly efficacious therapies when given in the right population. So that being said, there are two ways that we can prevent fractures. One is to slow the loss of bone, and in that category, as you mentioned, are the bisphosphonates and the SERMs, and in fact, estrogen. And the other way that we can treat osteoporosis is to try to build up the bone. And we only have one therapy that's approved in that realm, and it's called Forteo. And so looking at the bisphosphonates, they are by far the most widely prescribed osteoporosis medication, and they're taken orally. There's also an IV formulation. And as I said, they've been shown in a number of trials to reduce fractures by quite a bit. In the last, let's say, 2 to 3 years, there have been reports of, very rare reports, of fractures of the leg in unexpected conditions of patients who've been on bisphosphonates for longer periods of time. And that was what the panel, the FDA panel, tried to address. And so now they haven't made any specific recommendations other than to, you know, consider evaluating who should be on these therapies and make sure that the right people are on the therapies. We don't understand these fractures, and I think the biggest word of caution is that 100 hip fractures are prevented for every possible one of these rare atypical fractures. So we have to really keep the risk-benefit in mind when we're sort of thinking about the things we hear a lot about and get scared about.
Yeah. Well, there is also one other thing that I think has gotten, certainly has gotten some attention, I think maybe even more, and this is the increased risk of what still admittedly is a rare, but you don't want to get it, a jaw disease, osteonecrosis,
right,
which is pretty scary sounding. And I would imagine that, you know, some women having heard about this might, for them, that might be a reason to say, well, I don't want to take these medicines.
Right. Well, most of the studies and all the guidelines now suggest that this is a very, very, very rare occurrence in postmenopausal women. And where it has been a little bit bigger issue is patients who are taking bisphosphonates because they have cancer and they're trying to prevent metastatic disease. And they are on chemotherapeutic agents. They have a completely different immune system, and it's clear that there's a little, quite a bit bigger issue there. But in normal postmenopausal women taking bisphosphonates for risk of osteoporosis, it is really quite a small issue.
I would just jump in there quickly to add to that. I view use of any medicine as a benefit to risk decision, and the whole idea of timing and how long you should take something, well, how is your risk defined to start? There's actually an interesting site, more for clinicians, but it's the FRAX, kind of fracture predicting website, www.chef.ac.uk/frax /. But the point of that is that basically the way to think about these things, heart medicines, diabetes medicines, osteoporosis medicines, what's the benefit to risk? And so looking at your risk of a fracture and looking at a decision, and my gosh, I'm sure Dr. Buckstein could talk for several weeks about T-scores and what happens with bone mineral density testing and how people are selected for these things. But in general, whenever you start a medicine and you have a defined risk or you have a condition that you're treating or risk of a fracture in the case of osteoporosis, as time goes on, and you get the benefit of the bisphosphonate. And sure, some of the side effects are scary, but they're rare scary. You know, it basically says, well, you know, something we got to look at. Clearly more possible in people with cancer who are getting these medicines. Possibly also more prevalent in people with existing dental problems. And there's a little bit narrower benefit to risk decision. But after some amount of time, and that's a little controversial. Is it 2 years, 3 years? You can probably retest with a DEXA scanner every 2 years. And what's the risk then? In 4 years, after you've gotten the benefit of a treatment, of an osteoporosis treatment, if the risk is at a certain point, and Dr. Buckstein may see an emerging group of therapeutic decisions there, but if you reassess the risk, and you're no longer at such great risk, what you're starting to see in some of the discussion is a drug holiday.
Hmm. Exactly.
Well, I tell you what, I have another caller here. Let's get them. And this is somebody who's in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I hear some static on my phone. Are you getting it too?
Yes, but we can hear you fine, so go ahead.
Okay. I have a couple things to say about osteoporosis prevention. Vitamin D is really tough to get from the diet. It's almost impossible to get at least what many people now think is adequate amounts. Fatty fish has a little bit, and there's a little bit that's fortified in milk and a couple other things, but it's still really hard to get it.
You have to drink a lot of milk.
Yeah, huh? Like a couple gallons a day. So you have to get it either from sunshine or from supplements. And the sunshine in our part of the country, between the fall equinox and the spring equinox, you can be out in the sun and it won't do you any good because the ultraviolet in the atmosphere filters out the atmosphere filters out the ultraviolet that produces the vitamin D in the skin. So we almost have to resort to either to a sun tanning bed, which most people won't do, or to some sort of supplement. Besides that, there's something else which hasn't been mentioned, which has just been coming out in the last half dozen years, vitamin K2. Vitamin K1, which has been historically called just vitamin K, is easily gotten by most people from green vegetables, and it has to do with regulating the clotting of the blood. K2 has been mostly gotten in historical times, up until about 1950 or so in the United States, from grass-fed animals. But nowadays, almost all the animals in commercial production are fed on corn and soybeans, and so that both the meat and the milk are almost destitute of K2. And K2 is really hard to come by. The only ways that I know to get it from food are there's a special butter company called Organic Valley that makes a number of different kinds of butter, one of which is called pasture butter, and it's got K2 in it. There's also an imported butter from Ireland called Kerrygold. And if you're willing to be quite exotic, you can buy something called natto, locally from Amco, which is something most people really think is terrible the first time they eat it. But after a few days, at least I've gotten, so I've got a real taste for it.
Huh.
And you can, of course, get K2 from supplements. So if you can Google K2, vitamin K2, and the one that I think is the best is from Thorne, Thorne. K2 not only is, I think, crucial, the evidence is beginning to show that it's crucial, as vitamin D and calcium for osteoporosis prevention and remediation, it also has a lot to do with heart disease. What vitamin K2 seems to do is as your body absorbs calcium, K2 sees to it that it goes to your bones and teeth and not to your soft tissues and blood vessels. So it's a very crucial thing. And people who have osteoporosis should be on the alert for cardiovascular issues as well. So I'll stop there and see what you folks have to say.
Well, okay. Yeah, I'm interested in what either of you do want to say about that. Go ahead.
Sure. I've got a. I always have a comment, but in that sense, sure. K2 itself is sort of on the radar a little bit. Actually did an essential guide to medical news update on weight loss, and Manon Ballo, a sort of a health and fitness guru in Dallas, was a guest editor on that with me, and she started talking about K2, and there's actually a couple different subtypes of vitamin K2. They're very complicated names, but basically MK4 and MK7, and there's actually a conversion pathway. If you get into the science of this, and thank you, Manon, for making me smarter than I was about 6 months ago, but there's a MK4 is made from K1 in the body, testes, pancreas, and arterial wall. So there is that arterial component that's definitely correct. There's still somewhat of a sort of a loosey-goosey understanding of the pathway, just to be somewhat non-scientific. But in Japan, I think since the late 1990s, maybe mid, there's a MK4 that's been approved for prevention and treatment of osteoporosis. And, it's interesting in that sense. There's a little data that I'm aware of that for the osteoporosis. There's some question about steroids having an effect there as well. And I think I have to say that the heart data is emerging. There's emerging heart data for vitamin D. There is some for K, but I haven't seen a definitive study on that. But, it's something that, again, for different reasons than this particular topic, sort of came onto my radar. And it's something I think we need to look at. And going back to dietary supplements in general, we've got a little bit of a regulatory and a science problem. All of those supplements are basically regulated under the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, under the DSHEA. And I think we need to do a little bit better studying of them and certainly understanding and regulating them. But it's an interesting, K is interesting.
Professor Buckstein, anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, I certainly want to thank the caller for sort of clarifying how we can get vitamin D, and we're at the same situation here in Boston. We can't get a lot of vitamin D outside in the winter, and so that's a really great point that clarified what I said about it being the sunshine vitamin, and I would sort of agree about the emerging interest in vitamin K. It's coming on the radar screen, and we don't have guidelines. We don't know how much, but you know, the caller's point about it not being readily available more so now than even a decade ago is very important.
We're at the point here, we need to take a short break. I have another caller we'll get right to talk some more with our guests, Mary Buckstein and James Rybacki, in just a moment. First, a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We are here with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, you'll hear a conversation recorded in our studio last week with Don Gagne. He's an award-winning political correspondent for National Public Radio. He was actually visiting and was here and gave a talk here in our studios. He sat down in the studio with our Morning Edition host, Jim Meadows, and they talked about politics and political reporting, and you can hear that in hour number two. So that means in the second hour today, we'll not be taking calls. Tomorrow morning, we'll do our regular monthly show on personal finance, and there our guest will be David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I, and he's here once a month, talks a little bit about investing subjects, and then if you have questions about money management, you can call in. You can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we have two guests. We're taking questions about, generally, we can take questions about prescription medications, but specifically, we've been talking about osteoporosis. This is, in fact, World Osteoporosis Day, so it's a good day to be talking about it. And we have two guests joining us, Professor Mary Buckstein. She is Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Harvard Med School. She's also Adjunct Assistant Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Boston University. And the whole business of bones and bone health is something that she's particularly interested in. Also with us is Dr. James Rybacki. He's editor of the newsletter The Essential Guide to Medical News and also edits the website EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There's also the email, which is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let us go back to the phones and talk with someone next in Urbana, line number two.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Has anyone said anything about weight-bearing exercise? It's really great. It feels good to dance, to walk, to swim, too, for the upper body, and it makes me happy.
Well, and it's also, we did talk about that a little bit earlier, but again, you know, maybe I'll turn back here to Professor Buckstein. One of the things we really do want to remind people is that you do the nutritional things, yeah, that's good, but you also do need to have some weight-bearing exercise.
Right, certainly that, when we talked a little bit earlier about that, and I think it's one of the foundations for preventing fractures, and not only is exercise good in general for your heart and everything, for your skeleton, it will help preserve your bone. And probably I think the biggest bang for the buck that you get is more coordination, more muscle strength to help keep you from falling down. And a lot of fractures are due to falls, so that will go a long way.
Yeah, there are psychological benefits too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can tell you a story. It's about losing height, which has to do with all of this. Three women were overheard in Bloomingdale's, and one woman said, I used to be 5'8", and now I'm only 5'6". And the other woman says, I'm 5'6", and I used to be five, whatever it was. And the last woman said, I haven't lost any inches. And they said, may you live to be 5'2". So that's the story about losing height.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call.
I mean, it's not very significant, but thanks for talking about this.
All right, very good. And again, we also need to make the point when we're talking about weight-bearing exercise, that doesn't mean we're talking about lifting weights. But you know, walking would qualify.
Walking qualifies. Tai Chi exercises.
Dancing.
Dancing for sure.
Jogging, playing tennis, climbing stairs. I would jump back quickly as well and say not only do you get the benefit of the exercise and the balance and the sort of not falling, those sorts of things, but very, very clearly, I've talked about this in a number of different publications, if you look at exercise as a drug and consider it as something you need to do on a regular basis, you can have some dramatic effects on diabetes. 30 minutes, 5 days a week of moderate exercise can help you up to even 80% avoid some aspects of diabetes and certainly get better glucose control. You definitely, in a cardiovascular sense, there the AHA recommendation is 40 minutes on most days, which I know is a little challenging, but I'm here to be challenging because I want you to be healthy.
Yeah.
And the point is, if you can do that, you make fluffier cholesterol, you make a happier left ventricle, and you probably also make some endorphins, so you'd be in a better mood.
Well, that's and as the caller says, I think that many, many people will say that that's also another benefit of exercise. It has mood enhancing properties that you know, in addition to physically feeling better, maybe somehow in terms of your mood, you actually do feel better.
Well, I think unequivocally, there was actually some CDC data that there's about 11% of Americans now taking an antidepressant. Part of me would say, well, you know what, there's no reason to suffer with depression. And adding on a well-selected antidepressant makes very good sense. But if you look at some aspects of physical activity, and certainly the camaraderie and the fun, if you will, of a class, Mary mentioned Tai Chi, I would say any kind of jogging with someone, those sorts of things, dancing with someone, there you go.
Yeah.
Those are great things. And perhaps you can titrate off one of those pills, or if you need them, continue to take them, absolutely.
Okay, let's go to a caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I did have a question. I have a medical guru in St. Louis where I got a kidney transplant 23 years ago.
Wow.
I see him every couple or 3 years. And he recently recommended that I start taking a supplement of vitamin D3, 2,000 units daily. My local nephrologist mentioned that I could do that, but there is some debate about that, and I wondered, I'd like to hear a discussion of the pros and cons of vitamin D3.
Barry, you want to talk about that a little bit?
No, you can.
Okay. So looking at what happens, first of all, the interesting part is that 23 years ago, you had a kidney transplant. And so a couple of things come up with that. I was recently in an interim in charge of everything with medicines at UT Southwestern Medical Centers, two hospitals, a cancer center, and a couple other activities there. And they have a very active transplant service. So I have to assume that sir, you're continuing to take a rejection kind of medicine, a cyclosporin or tacrolimus, something like that?
Cyclosporin and prednisone.
Yep. And so when you look at risk factors for osteoporosis and you look at the effects of medicines, if you go to www.niams.nih.gov and you look at osteoporosis in there, those kind of medications will come up under medications associated with osteoporosis. And so looking at what happens with vitamin D and trying to help that, did he talk to you about that? This is what we're doing? We're actually giving you a little bit larger dose?
Well, no, I hadn't been taking this supplement at all. All I'm taking is Miacalcin.
No, okay, so let's go back to our listeners' understanding a little bit. So Miacalcin is actually a calcitonin salmon. And so
right.
The question with that is in, you're taking that as a nasal spray?
Yes.
Yep. And so that's one of those things you spray in your nose. And the interesting part about that is that some of the data for that particular medicine said that it didn't really have as robust a bone-building effect as the bisphosphonates did or some of the newer ones, but it actually had a pain management component. And so going back to that, did your doc talk about that? Did you have a fracture in the spine, and was it hurting?
Oh, I have multiple compression fractures,
okay.
And I fractured my hip, and we tried the bisphosphonates, so my creatinine would start to go up. So calcitonin is it.
Yep. Oh, no,
yep.
I get it. Yep. And that actually makes great sense. The other thing that's very clear about that particular medicine is that actually does have a pain-relieving effect. So that you're getting sort of elegant pharmacotherapy, which makes, you know, interesting sense. So, yeah, interesting, and it sounds like you do have a guru, and the fact that you've had a kidney for 23 years, that's tremendous. That's an early transplant, my gosh.
Yeah, well, I wondered, was there a controversy about whether or not to take vitamin D3?
Well, so vitamin D is actually a group of fat-soluble vitamins, and it's sort of a... I think the best way to say it, vitamin D is like a pro-hormone, and the body can make sort of its own vitamin D3 when sun exposure, back to Dr. Buckstein's sunshine vitamin, is adequate. For a lot of us, though, there's a very clear concern about melanoma, and so if you're using a sunscreen, which you should, even though you're getting some exposure to the sun, you may not be getting the benefit of making that active component. So the issue with the D3 is that you're actually putting into your body that form that your body can make, albeit perhaps not to an extent that you need. So the other question is, did you have a vitamin D level?
Not recently.
Okay, that may be something interesting to do. Is that what I always like to do, when you start something, supplement or not, medicine or not, if there's a metric, a measurement, a lab test you can get, let's see where you are, what the benefit is when you're starting to take that. And did he actually write this as a prescription, he or she? Was it he or she?
He.
Okay. Did he write it as a prescription?
It's on a prescription pad, yes.
Uh-huh.
The way he suggested this is Dr. Dan Brennan. I don't know if you... remember with him or not.
Yep, no, I'm not.
But
it's certainly in the sense of the longevity of your organ and what's happened there with that complicated group of medicines as well, which are typically taken for transplant rejection. I would ask him specifically, so did you think I'm not getting enough sun? Are you going to a tanning bed or something like that?
Oh, heavens. My dermatologist run a regular basis.
Got it.
He tells me to stay out of the sun.
Yes.
Because I do have multiple epithelial skin cancers.
Yep. And so the other piece of that is some component of skin health, and there is some question about that. I mentioned that earlier in the program. The data I'm familiar with is about 1,000 IU of vitamin D and some help with melanoma. So there may be a new paper that I'm not aware of, but I would ask them that specific question. Do you have a paper or a research piece that you can follow up? It'd be interesting to read more about.
No, actually. He just told me this was a good idea, and my local nephrologist, though, had said there was some debate about this particular vitamin
D. Yeah, about D in general and how much. Definitely.
I don't think there's anything specific about vitamin D3 that you need to worry about. It just has become more recently debatable about what's the optimal level. And I think at 1,000 to 2,000 units a day, you may be somewhat deficient and your physician is trying to raise your levels. And then, as Dr. Rybecki said, you have them checked again, and if they're back in the normal range, maybe you cut back a little bit.
All right, I think I've got the picture.
All right, well, thank you. We're coming down to about 5 minutes left. Other questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. For a second, I'd like to go back to the conversation we were having about bisphosphonates, and you talked a little bit about some potential side effects people may have heard about, admittedly rare, but things that you should at least be concerned about and aware of. There is a side effect to bisphosphonates that's maybe not quite so problematic but more common, and that is stomach upset, gastric trouble. And that's why, I guess, there has been this move to forms of the medication that you don't take every day. And I wonder, is there anything in terms of kind of standard advice you give to patients who are taking these medicines who then also say, yeah, it really upsets their stomach?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, you have to make sure that you're taking the medicine appropriately. And bisphosphonates in general, or oral bisphosphonates, are very poorly absorbed. And so the instructions taking the medicine are to take it first thing in the morning on an empty stomach with a full glass of water, and then remain upright for 30 minutes. And so part of minimizing the gastric discomfort and maximizing the efficacy of the drug is due to following those sort of instructions. And so for one, you want to try to do that. And I'm not aware of any other ways that one can try to minimize the potential discomfort that some patients experience. And if that becomes a concern, I think talk to your physician. There are alternatives. There are bisphosphonates that are given IV once a year for people who are intolerant to oral bisphosphonates. And there are also new medicines on the market that are not bisphosphonates and that are also given by a subcutaneous injection twice a year. So we have new therapies and sort of options for people who are intolerant to oral bisphosphonates.
That's interesting. That's definitely where I would have gone to as well. There's the monthly component, and obviously, as Dr. Buckstein mentioned, the IV annual form. But, you know, again, that idea of taking it with that, a full glass of water is like 8 ounces. Let me make that very clear. It's not a little bathroom cup. And what you're doing is you're putting the drug, and I would say take part or three-quarters of that, maybe a fourth of that first, and then take the pill and then take the rest of it. And that water actually can do a lot for protection.
All right.
Not laying down, obviously.
Okay, yeah, very good.
I do have one thing, David, I would like to jump in.
Yes.
Through the miracle of a search while we were on the break, there is, and I apologize for being remiss in not saying that, there is a generic Imitrex, which is a medicine that the caller had asked about earlier. It's actually from Par Pharmaceuticals, so if she goes back and looks at Imitrex, there is indeed that generic form that's already out there.
Mm. Okay. That's
the other way to look at that is that to go to www.fda.gov and then search the drug and then search generic with it.
Yeah. Just we got a couple of minutes left, but just on the subject of things coming off patent, I thought this was really interesting. This is not exactly new. It's an article that I came across from a couple of months ago that apparently Lipitor, which is the most prescribed drug in the world, is the patent on Lipitor is going to expire next month.
So that is correct. Lipitor. I happen to have this on my desk. I don't know how you asked that question, but by total prescriptions, there's about 37 million prescriptions a year, and the generic name of that is atorvastatin, very, very widely used. I actually have a publication on that as well, looking at cholesterol medicines and the HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. So what you get is a multi-billion dollar, very well-researched, tremendously efficacious medicine that now is going to be much less expensive. It's amazing when you look at how these things happen.
Yeah. In this particular article, there also was this, apparently some people suggested that, well, maybe Lipitor should just be available over the counter. So, like, you could just go into your pharmacy and just buy it off the shelf. And a lot of other people said, no, that's a terrible idea.
I believe in patient empowerment. But that, because of the benefit-to-risk questions, because of the possible muscle challenges that can come up with that particular family of medicines, I think that could be very, very challenging. Because the other piece of this is, if Lipitor at a particular dose is not reaching the goal. You always have to set a timeline and a goal for medicines and talk to your doctor and make sure you understand where this is supposed to happen on the calendar. It's called treatment to goal. And if you're not at goal, and if your lipids, the good and bad cholesterol, and the five at least different kinds of good cholesterol aren't working as hard as they might for you, you need to change the dose, and you might need to change the drug, and you might need some combination therapy. So I think we need a physician involved in that, a nurse practitioner, a someone with a lot more training than someone just walking in and getting a drug.
Yeah. Just one other thing real quick I thought I would mention is because I'm sure in the past we've talked about the problem of what do people do with old medicine. And for a while, people were told, well, flush it down the toilet. Then we started saying, no, that's a bad thing. Well, apparently at the end of this month, on the 29th, there's going to be a thing all over the country. It's going to be National Take Back Prescription Drug Day.
Yep.
And it's sponsored by, I believe it's the DEA actually is behind it. So there are a lot of places, and I guess probably most of these places, there are pharmacies.
Yep.
There are places where if you have some old medicine, you don't want it hanging around, you shouldn't just throw it in the trash, you can actually take it and it will be disposed of properly.
Well, that's actually a crucial thing. There was some studies looking at New York City drinking water, and there was a 2006 study, which was the first one, and it found about half of the people putting the medications in the toilet. And so the FDA has sort of come up with sort of a no-flush rule. There are some state and local governments, the DEA is clearly that. It's www.justice.gov.dea, and you can get that information as well. There's a Smart RX disposal or public awareness campaign that was started. There's some private companies, certainly in the sense of controlled medicines, pain medicines, those sorts of things. You need to be careful about diversion. And I think it's long overdue that there was a source, a well-publicized, hey, bring it into this pharmacy and we'll take care of it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. I want to say thanks very much to our two guests, Dr. Mary Buckstein. She is assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Harvard Med School, also adjunct assistant professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Boston University. Professor Buckstein, thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure being here, David. Thank you.
And Jim Rybacki. He's editor. Tom, yeah, thank you, Tom. I don't know why I do that. He is the editor of the newsletter, The Essential Guide to Medical News, and also edits the website, EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. A lot of good information there, so you can check it out. Jim, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
All over the country, it's going to be National Take Back Prescription Drug Day.
Yep.
And it's sponsored by, I believe it's the DEA actually is behind it. So there are a lot of places, and I guess probably most of these places, there are pharmacies.
Yep.
There are places where if you have some old medicine, you don't want it hanging around, you shouldn't just throw it in the trash, you can actually take it and it will be disposed of properly.
Well, that's actually a crucial thing. There was some studies looking at New York City drinking water, and there was a 2006 study, which was the first one, and it found about half of the people putting the medications in the toilet. And so the FDA has sort of come up with sort of a no-flush rule. There are some state and local governments, the DEA is clearly that. It's www.justice.gov.dea, and you can get that information as well. There's a Smart RX disposal or public awareness campaign that was started. There's some private companies, certainly in the sense of controlled medicines, pain medicines, those sorts of things. You need to be careful about diversion. And I think it's long overdue that there is a source, a well-publicized, hey, bring it into this pharmacy and we'll take care of it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. I want to say thanks very much to our two guests, Dr. Mary Buckstein. She is assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Harvard Med School, also adjunct assistant professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Boston University. Professor Buckstein, thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure being here, David. Thank you.
And Jim Rybacki. He's editor. Tom, yeah, thank you, Tom. I don't know why I do that. He is the editor of the newsletter, The Essential Guide to Medical News, and also edits the website, EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. A lot of good information there, so you can check it out. Jim, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
We'll take a quick break here for an update on the markets and some news. We'll be back with more Focus. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Soybean futures at the Chicago Board of Trade are on the downside and defensive for a fourth straight session, pressured by long liquidation, as well as traders unwinding long soybean short corn positions. Also providing some downward pressure momentum is a downturn in U.S. crude oil futures and an upturn in the U.S. dollar. And let's go ahead and look at some particular